We come now in our study of Genesis 1 to the climactic moment in this creative process. We come to the apex of creation, the creature for which all the rest of creation was made. We come to the creation of man. But is man unique among the other life forms here on earth? Is man superior to the beast of the earth, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea? Is there something special about human life that makes it precious, even sacred, in comparison to plant and animal life? Now, I know most of us would agree that man is indeed unique by virtue of the fact that he is God's creature and he is created in the image of God. But there are growing numbers of people in our culture today who reject these ideas, and they reject the idea of the sanctity of life, agreeing with philosopher Peter Singer, who said, "The notion that human life is sacred just because it is human life is medieval." This particular philosopher is having a tremendous amount of influence in the intellectual circles in Western culture. And these kinds of ideas are becoming more and more the norm. A bit of recent news from Spain is an example of this growing notion in our culture. Spain gives rights to apes. Spain's parliament on Wednesday voiced its support for the rights of great apes to life and freedom, Reuters reports. Spain adopted this new policy at the behest of the Great Apes Project, a plan developed in part by Peter Singer and other philosophers and scientists who say the animals deserve the same rights as their closest genetic relatives. Australian-born Singer, dubbed the godfather of animal rights, has stirred up controversy by asserting, among other things, that Christianity is a problem for the animal rights movement. A professor of bioethics at Princeton University's Center for Human Values, Singer attacks speciesism, which he defines as the belief that being a member of a certain species makes you superior to any other being that is not a member of that species. He also stated that a severely disabled infant may be killed up to 28 days after its birth if the parents deem the baby's life is not worth living. Spain's Environmental Committee of Parliament approved the resolution with cross-party support. If the resolution becomes law, it will mean that potential experiments on apes will be banned within a year. In addition, apes used for commercial purposes, filming or circuses would become illegal. This is a historic day in the struggle for animal rights and in defense of our evolutionary comrades, which will doubtless go down in the history of humanity, Pedro Pozas, Spanish director of the Great Apes Project, tells Reuters. We have no knowledge of great apes being used in experiments in Spain, but there is currently no law preventing that from happening, Pozas notes. Apes in Spanish zoos, of which there are currently 315, will remain legal, according to the legislation, but living conditions reportedly will improve substantially. So evidently the apes will move from cages to condos in an effort to accommodate our closest genetic relatives. Now, I want you to notice something that Singer said. And this guy, he's a professor at Princeton. I was at Princeton a few years ago walking around the campus. I was doing a retreat in Princeton, New Jersey. And as I was walking the campus and noticing the statues of some of the great evangelists and spiritual leaders of the, back around the time of the founding of the nation, statues of men like George Whitefield and George Tenet. And to think that a man with this kind of mentality and atheistic hostility toward God and the Christian faith, that he would hold a professorship at that university, it's quite tragic, really. But notice what Singer is saying here. He talks about this speciesism. In actuality, that is a direct attack against the biblical view of man being Lord of creation and the sole bearer of God's image. So he's very much an opponent of the biblical worldview. I bring this up once again to show you the relevance of these chapters in Genesis. And once again to remind you that the things that we see going on in our culture today and in our world today are nothing less than part of this great cosmic battle that we are in. It really is, in its essence, the more you look at it and the more you understand what's happening in our culture, you really begin to realize this is a war between God and Satan. And what we are seeing in these kinds of ideas that are proliferating in our culture, we're seeing this attack from the enemy against God, the things of God. We're seeing this increase right before our eyes. So we come to our text tonight, Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. And there we read, "Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them." We'll stop there. The first thing to notice, just in passing, we're not going to spend any time on this. We touched on it some time back. But notice the plurality. Let us make man in our image. God is speaking. And just a reminder to us of the biblical teaching that there is a plurality within the divine nature. That God is one, but yet there is a plurality within that one. And of course, this is a hint at what would later become clearly revealed in the New Testament period, the doctrine of the Trinity. I was listening to a debate a few days ago between a man named Jay Smith, who debates radical Islamic fundamentalists in Hyde Park in London. And one of the things that the Muslims will often get riled up about, and they'll begin to chant and to shout about their belief in one God, and they will criticize and mock us Christians as believing in three gods. And as I was listening to this debate, this kind of thing began to take place. And the Muslims, being led by this particular person, they were all, chanting, there was one God, one God, one God. And they were then mocking the Christians for believing in three gods and so forth. And, as I was listening to that, I was thinking, Of course, Christianity predates Islam by 600 plus years. The idea of one God or the monotheistic idea certainly was not part of Arabic culture. This idea originates with Israel. It originates with the Jews. The Jews were the one people in the ancient world who were known for their monotheism. And so we have the whole idea of one God originating with the Jews. And of course, Jesus and the apostles, the authors of the New Testament, they were all Jews. And of course, the New Testament teaches clearly that there is one God. The New Testament predates Islam by at least 600 years. And you think, you know, here's this group of people that have stolen this idea. And now, you know, they're laying claim to it like they're the ones that it originated with. And I was reading an article yesterday. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, a pitiful fellow. Recently, a few months back, he was talking about the need for Britain to introduce Sharia law. Now, in his most recent speech, which I read yesterday, he's warning Christians that we shouldn't be talking so much about the Trinity or be so dogmatic about that because that's offensive to Muslims. And, you know, you just think, what on earth are these people thinking? But this monotheistic idea, Islam stole it. It belonged to the Jews. It belonged to the Christians. It still belongs to the Jews and the Christians. But in a sense, you know, they've sort of hijacked it and, you know, become the ones now to supposedly, you know, promote this idea of one God. But that one God, as we see here in our text, that one God exists in a plurality within his nature. There are three persons, and again, it is hinted at here. Now, that was just a little diversion. That's not what I want to talk about tonight, but just wanted to mention that briefly. But notice, God is saying, let us make man in our image and according to our likeness. Now, everyone that I consulted as far as Hebrew authorities, they agree that the words image and likeness, there is not enough of a difference to make any real difference. Basically, just the same thing is being stated. But what is being spoken of here? This is a question that we need to address, and it's something that we need to understand. I remember seeing a blasphemous little comic strip a few years ago where there was a extremely obese man sitting on his couch in front of the television with, you know, a bag of potato chips spilling over and a bunch of empty beer cans. And there the caption was, created in the image of God. What does it mean when the Bible speaks of man being created in the image of God? Well, it does not refer primarily to physical likeness, although I do think that there is perhaps some connection there, but that is not primarily what it refers to. Interestingly, in verse 27, we have the third, fourth, and fifth occurrence of the Hebrew word bara. And you remember the meaning of that word. It means to create from nothing. And so when it says that God created man in his image, it's using that Hebrew word bara, which of course must then be referring not to the physical body of man or to the material aspect of man, but to the immaterial aspect of man. We know that God created man's body from the dust of the earth. But we're told here that God created man from nothing, so it's speaking primarily, I believe, of the spiritual aspect of man. But perhaps there is some physical likeness. God apparently designed our physical bodies so that we can do many of the things that we're told in Scripture that God does. So that we can see, so that we can hear, so that we can touch, speak, think, plan, and so forth. To quote one commentator, he said, "It would hardly be safe to say that the body of man is patterned after God, because God, being an incorporeal spirit, cannot have what we term a material body. Yet the body of man must at least be regarded as the fittest receptacle for the man's spirit, and so must bear at least an analogy that is so close that God and his angels choose to appear in human form when they appear to men." Now, what he says here, this commentator, Leupold, he says that God, being an incorporeal spirit, cannot have what we term a material body. And of course, if we understand what spirit is, we would agree with that. But I ask the question myself, does that mean that God cannot have a spiritual body? And I think that you can build support from the Scripture that God is in some sort of bodily form. It's not material like the material that we're made of, or it's not matter in the sense of what God created when he created the material universe. But in different passages of Scripture, we find, for example, God being seated upon the throne, and there is the image, there is a bodily image of God that is being referred to there. If you think of Revelation chapter 4 and Revelation chapter 5, there in Revelation chapter 5, we have one who's sitting upon the throne, and there's that glorious description that's given of him. And then in his right hand, there is a scroll. And of course, the Lamb comes and takes the scroll out of his hand. So, although God doesn't possess a material body like we do, it seems to me that there is some correspondence in some way between our physical bodies and God's spiritual body. And I can't say anything more about it, and nobody else can either, because we just don't know. But it does seem that there is some connection, perhaps. But again, what is primarily being spoken of here is the immaterial part of man. We are body, soul, and spirit. The body, of course, is the material element. Our soul and our spirit are the immaterial elements of man. So when we read here in Genesis that God created man in his image, in the image of God created he him, what is that referring to exactly? Well, I think there are three things that are being specifically referred to. First of all, God created us with personality. We are persons with personality, and our physical bodies are simply a means of communicating that, but you know that your physical body is not you. Entirely. You know intuitively, you know that there's something else that's you that's more or less just living in this physical body. This is a temporary dwelling place. It's a tent. The Bible refers to it as a tent. And this is something that we as people know more or less intuitively. I have this vivid memory of lying in my bed when I was a little kid. I was probably 6 or 7 years old. But I remember it to this day. I remember lying there trying to figure out how you could die. And what I was trying to understand is, you know, how could you stop existing? How could I, even though I was a little boy at the time, but, you know, I am this distinct entity. How could I just not exist? And the reality is, I was onto something there. You don't just stop existing. Your body might die, but that's just the material part of you. The immaterial part of us, of course, we know lives on. So, first of all, personality. Now, to have personality, one must possess knowledge, feelings, and a will. And, of course, that can be said of God. It can be said of us as well. We can say that animals possess a certain degree of personality. But an animal does not reason as men do. I find myself sometimes trying to reason with my dog. You know, she just doesn't get it. She doesn't understand why she shouldn't do the kinds of things she does. Because animals, they cannot reason as men do. They only react to certain problems or stimuli. An animal does not create anything in the sense that people do. It only conforms to certain behavior patterns, even in as elaborate a pattern as constructing a nest, hive, or a dam. Again, it's more of an instinctive sort of a thing rather than a real creative type of a thing. Animals do not love as humans do. They only reproduce. And of course, animals do not worship. So personality, in the sense that we're speaking of here, is something that links man to God, but it does not link either man or God to the rest of creation. I think one of the strongest and oftentimes overlooked manifestations of man being in the image of God is the fact that man is a creator. You see, out of all life in the world, man is a creator. And what we know historically as civilizations are really man's creation and are indirect evidence that man has been created. But think about the creativity of man. Think about all the things that men have produced over the centuries, over the millennia. Think of some of the great buildings. There are ancient structures, there are modern structures that are just phenomenal. They're unbelievable feats. With my children living up in the Bay Area, it's taken us across the Golden Gate Bridge many times in the last few years. And every time I cross that bridge, I just think, astounding. But, you know, a lot of this stuff, we just sort of take it for granted. But if you think about it in those terms, all that we see that has been produced by men is evidence of man's creativity. Think of the poems, the plays, the songs, the pictures. Think of the electronic gadgets, the cars, the airplanes, the space shuttles. You know, it's really quite astounding when you think about it. And especially when you realize that there's not another creature in all of time, anywhere that we've ever evidenced, there's not another creature that is even remotely close in those creative types of abilities or processes. There's nothing that even remotely compares to it. You know, there are some fascinating things that animals and insects can do. But by comparison, they are relatively insignificant. But man is a creator. And as a creator, he is reflecting his image. And so this is all part of that attribute of personality, knowledge, feelings, will. But then, secondly, being created in God's image implies morality. The great distinction between right and wrong belongs to man alone. You know that. Listen to what Darwin said in regard to that. He said, "I fully subscribe to the judgment of those writers who maintain that of all the differences between man and the lower animals, the moral sense or conscience is by far the most important. This sense is summed up in the short but imperious word ought, so full of high significance. It is the most noble of all the attributes of man." So even Darwin himself, he saw this and realized, okay, this is problematic for my theories, because you don't find this anywhere else, the distinction between right and wrong. But then thirdly, being created in the image of God would refer to our spirituality. Now, only man possesses a spirit. Plant life is bodily life. Animal life is soulish life, but human life is spiritual life. Human life has that other element of the soulish, but we have the additional dimension of the spirit that is not the experience of any other of the created beings. Man alone possesses a spirit, and it's through our spirits that we're aware of God. We have a consciousness of God. It's through our spirits that we commune with God. Man alone is a worshiper. And all men in all times and all places have this in common, that they worship. Again, obviously you don't find this in any other area of life. You don't find this at all. There's nothing even close to it. But with all people, for all times, in all places, there is this common denominator of worshiping a superior being or a supreme being, or worshiping something other, or something above and beyond themselves. Even those who refer to themselves as atheists today, you find if you listen to them closely enough, you can detect who their God is. They have a God, and oftentimes in our day it's science or philosophy, it's the intellect basically, it's their own brilliance or something like that. They're worshiping themselves. But this is the common denominator among all human beings. We possess personality. We know that there is a distinction between right and wrong, and there is that spiritual element. So when the Bible speaks of us being made in the image and in the likeness of God, that's primarily what it's referring to. Not our physical bodies, although there might be somewhat of a connection there. It's the immaterial part of man that's being spoken of. Now there are some other things that attest to man being made in God's image. But again, these are things that we don't really stop to think about. But if you spend just a few moments pondering these things, it's really quite amazing. Think of this. Man alone has a natural countenance looking upward. I mean, this is something that even the evolutionists, of course, have latched onto, the whole idea of Homo erectus, you know, the man standing upright versus the ape hunched over. And even in the evolutionary theories, that's where the real distinction comes. It becomes the distinction is there between the upright man and the hunched over man. But, you know, again, these are things that we don't so much think about. But if you stop and think about it, it's a pretty amazing thing. Out of all of the creatures in all of the world, only man is upright and his natural glance is upward rather than downward. Man alone has a variety of facial expressions. Again, these are things that I know that I don't think too much about. But as I read over some of these things and some of the comments made on them, and as I started to think about it, I thought, wow, you know, that's true. But we alone, we have this ability to sometimes even speak without speaking, don't we? We've all heard the saying, if looks could kill, boy, you'd be dead. What are we talking about? We're talking about the ability to communicate just through facial expression. That's a human trait. Only a human trait. Man alone, here is a really interesting one to me. Man alone has a sense of shame expressing itself in a blush. Man alone has an innate sense of shame over certain things. Now, again, I don't want to get graphic at all, but you know, if you have a pet, you have an animal of any sort, you know that they're not ashamed of anything. They have no shame when it comes to going out in the street and, you know, starting to chow on that dead animal that was hit by a car last night. There's no shame whatsoever. You can protest all you want. That's disgusting. That's a get away from there. And there's no shame. But we alone, we have that sense of shame. When we've done something wrong or when we've been caught doing something that we know we shouldn't have been doing, and that shame will manifest itself in a blush that we have no control over. But here is probably the greatest distinguishing factor that we so often overlook because we take it so much for granted. Man alone speaks. Man alone speaks. Now, the evolutionists, they have been working overtime with different animals, trying to get them to learn to speak. Because, of course, their theories would lead them to believe that animals ought to be able to communicate. They ought to be able to have a language. They probably do have a language. We just have to, you know, tap into it and understand it. Surely they have, you know, very similar capacities to us. And they've done much work with apes because apes are, as far as the DNA goes, they're very close to us when it comes to their DNA. But in all of their attempts to teach apes to speak or to even use sign language or to communicate in the most elementary form, the types of forms that a two-year-old can communicate in, they have utterly failed on all accounts. I read an article by my friend Fred Field on the subject of language and this whole issue here of this distinct feature in man regarding language. He said, there is a great gulf between human language and animal communication. As a result, one must wonder how it is that every member of humankind has this capacity while none of the other 10 million or so species does. If chimps and humans are equally evolved, or developed having a common ancestor, as evolutionary thinking would have us believe, then why is it that no other primate species also has it, at least in some form? All things being equal, the premise for the Planet of the Apes series of films seems quite reasonable, assuming the accepted beliefs of evolutionary thinking. Furthermore, applying the principles of equal development to a wider sample, one must ask why orders of reptilians that have presumably been around longer than their mammal counterparts have not also developed some sort of language skills. This is the stuff of science fiction, not true science. Apparently, we are to assume that the mathematical probabilities are 1 in 10 million that any species will develop language, and humans are the winners. We just happen to have the optimal biological makeup and inhabit the optimal planet with the optimal environment in the optimal solar system in the optimal galaxy. The knowledge of language sets us apart from all other species that we know of so far. It is part of our unique heritage, our biological endowment. Its significance may be difficult to appreciate because so many aspects of it are unconscious and taken for granted. We are simply unaware of what we do when we do language. From a biblical perspective, it is an aspect of our humanity that links us to the infinite. It allows us to gain and express real knowledge, to learn of our respective environments and ourselves, and ultimately to reach many things and ideas that are beyond our individual capabilities. The obvious coherence of language and the language faculty raises significant questions about how random mutations could possibly account for such profound and effective order. So language itself, it's baffles. These evolutionary scientists are baffled why these primates aren't able to communicate like they ought to be able to if their theories are accurate. And yet it's something that is so instinctive with us as people. And so these are all of the things that are implied in being created in the image of God. Now, you know, to me, and I would imagine to you as well, this stuff is as plain as the nose on your face. It's so obvious that man is distinct from the rest of creation. And the irony with these humanistic atheists, with these men that have embraced these evolutionary ideas, the irony is that all of the evidence, everything points in the opposite direction of their theories, but they still hold tenaciously to their theories. In the face of all of the evidence against it, they still cling to their theories, saying, we're going to find that missing link. We're going to, I don't know if you saw last Thursday in the paper. I don't know if you saw, the discovery, the missing link they've now discovered. The missing link is somewhere between a flounder and a halibut. And over millions of years, one of the eyes drifted over to the other side of the head. And I'm telling you, I'm reading this stuff and I just can't believe that it's even printed in the news. And even the guys that are promoting the idea that it's the missing link, you can tell by reading the article that they really are grasping at straws. You can tell that, they themselves don't believe this is the missing link. But it's the best we've got up until this point. Now, we're talking about man being created in the image of God, and we're talking about all of the glory of that, and we're talking about the personality and the morality and the spirituality. But of course, we don't see that as we look around us today, do we? And that is because man is not presently
what he originally was or what he was intended to be. And we will get to the reason for that a bit later in our study. But of course, the reason is man fell from his high position of that relationship with God. And having fallen from that high position, instead of seeking to regain that position, that relationship, man keeps going further and further and further in the wrong direction. And that's what we see happening all around us today in our world. Man is uniquely created in the image of God. The missing link is not Neanderthal man, Peking man, Java man. The missing link is the God-man, Jesus Christ. And the problem is the vast majority of people are looking for the connection. You know, it's funny. Everybody evidently senses that there's some connection to something in the past, and they're in hot pursuit of trying to find out what that is. And they ridicule us for what they call simplistic thinking, that there's a God who just created everything. And they ridicule us for worshiping and serving God. But the things that they have taken and elevated really in many ways to God's status, and they have a reverence that in some cases puts us to shame. Some years ago, when they claimed that they had, found the bits and pieces of our most ancient ancestors, and they were going to display these bone parts in one of the museums in Britain, they took these bone fragments and they locked them in a case and they placed them in something equivalent to like an armored truck. And they had a long procession, an entourage, to the museum. And they took these things and they placed them behind bulletproof glass. Bone fragments. And all of the anthropologists gathered around and they oohed and they awed and they worshipped, is basically what they're doing. I think it was with Lucy. The so-called missing link that they called Lucy. And, there's this reverence, there's this devotion, there's this commitment that is so powerful. It is a religious commitment. And if you contradict it, if you challenge it, if you question it, even if you're within the system, if you question it, you are excommunicated from the community. It's astounding. And all over this country, as we saw in the film Expelled, many professors have been expelled from their position because they have dared to question Darwinism. So it's a battle. As it's often presented from the press, it's supposedly a battle against science and religion, or science, and they like to refer to it more as superstition. But it's not that at all. It is a battle of worldviews. It is a battle of philosophies. It is a battle that comes down to one of two options. Either God created us in His image, and we are what we are because of His creative power, and therefore we are obviously then accountable to Him as our Creator. That's the one option, which is completely unacceptable to them. And the other, of course, is that no one created us. We are all the byproduct of random chance, and ultimately we have no actual accountability to a higher being. There then can be no absolute moral code. There can be no absolute right or wrong. And in the end, all of this structure is erected to allow men to live the way they want and to not have any guilt or any fear of retribution in regard to it. That's what everything really boils down to. But for me, and for you too, I know, many of you, the God option is such a better option. It's so much better. Because all of those things that you want to do, that you've got to get rid of God so you can do them, you find that those things never really satisfy you anyway. There's nothing that satisfies the human soul apart from communion with the one who made us. And you can run and you can deny and you can reject and you can resist, but in the end, you're only inflicting harm upon yourself. Because you're running away from and rejecting the one who made you, the one who loves you, the one who made you with a purpose, the one who wants to bless you. So, I often, as I read some of the things that people say and as I listen to their arguments, I think, you know, we are living in a world where men have gone insane. It really is, I call it a sin-induced insanity. But it really is, you know, if you really listen to what these guys are saying, if you think through what they're talking about, this is insanity. It makes no sense. And, you know, what is a mark of insanity? It's unreasonableness. It's something that makes no sense whatsoever. When a person is insane, they just babble. They just talk in riddles and you don't know what they're talking about. And they don't know what they're talking about. It doesn't make a bit of sense. And so it is when you read the most articulate of these philosophers. In the end, you look at it and think, you know, this doesn't make a bit of sense. And it's like man has lost his mind in his attempt to do away with God's rule over his life. He's lost his mind. We're living in a world full of insane people. When all God wants to do is bless, all He wants to do is reveal His goodness and His grace. You know, all God wants to do is good for man. That's what He wants to do. He wants to come into our lives and bless us. And only an insane person would say, no, I don't want that. Created in the image of God. Created in the image of God. Created for God. And the final word is that man is related to God and our hearts will find no rest until we are reunited with Him. We're related to God. Isn't that a great thought, though, when you think about it? You know, another manifestation of the insanity, and there's such contradictory ideas. You have on the one hand, sometimes you know, you're listening to these philosophers, these evolutionary, atheistic philosophers and so forth, and you have on the one hand, they're elevating man to the point of deity. And on the other hand, you have guys like Peter Singer who are saying, you know, man is no more significant than a chimpanzee. Man is no more significant than any other life form whatsoever. It's no difference between bashing a baby seal in the head with a club or bashing a human being in the head with a club. So right there you see, okay, well, which is it? Is man a deity or is he just slime? And they sort of vacillate between the two. If it's advantageous to their cause, then God, then man is a god. But if it's advantageous to their cause, then man is slime. It's confusion. It's craziness. The biblical picture of life, the biblical picture of the world, fits so much better with reality. It fits so much better with everything we see and with everything that we know intuitively. You know, the philosophers try to tell us today there is no meaning in life. Life is purposeless. But you know what? You know, and I know, that that isn't true. How do I know that? I just know it. I know it intuitively. I know that there's significance to my life. You know that there's significance to your life. Everybody knows that. You got to get brainwashed out of believing that, because it's intuitive. Why is it there? It's there because God put that in us. There is, in one sense, innately in us the knowledge that we are created in the image of God. That there is something special about man. That no, you don't go out and kill people just because you feel like it. There's something about human life. We know it intuitively. Now, most people don't feel bad about chopping off a chicken's head. They're going to cook it for dinner. And most of us don't feel bad about, you know, we don't actually go through the process, but we go down to the market and we buy ribs and we buy steak and we buy different things. And we don't feel bad about that at all. And we shouldn't. Because God made these things for these purposes. But none of us would ever dream about chopping up a person and putting them in the freezer to eat on 4th of July at the family barbecue, would we? Why wouldn't we do that? And you know what? You don't even have to read the Bible to know that you're not supposed to do that. You just know that you don't do that. That's what many of the missionaries found with the cannibalistic tribes that they went to evangelize. The cannibals that never had a Bible, never were influenced by Western Christian ideas. But they themselves would confess that they knew that their cannibalism was wrong. It's intuitive. It's innate. It's all related back to this whole thing that we are created in the image of God. And one final note. Again, for me, thinking about these things, it's thrilling. It's thrilling to think that I am created in God's image and all of the implications of that. And I've been redeemed by Him and I have a relationship with Him and I'm His child. And we all know what it's like. If we're parents, we know the affections that we have for our children. We know how we love to lavish our love upon them. We know how we love to spend time with them. We know how we want to bless them and do every good thing that we can possibly do for them. And when we stop and think about being created in the image of God, being the children of God, and we realize that all of those things that we have, all of those natural affections that we have toward our loved ones, that God has all of those toward us. That's such a thrilling thing. It's such a blessing. It's such a wonderful thing. It's so comforting to know that tonight, if we've got anything that's weighing us down, if we've got issues in our life, if we've got struggles or problems or whatever, that we have a God who made us, a God who loves us, a God who knows more about us than we could ever know about ourselves, and we can come straight to His throne boldly, and we can cry out for help, and He will help. Because we are what creation was all about. All of that preparation, the bringing into existence of all of the matter, the forming of the earth, bringing the vegetation, animal life, all of that was all preparatory for this one creature. And that's us. And if that doesn't comfort, encourage, bless you, then just add one more to it. Remember that God demonstrated His love toward us ultimately in that Christ died for us. So God made us, and we already know the story. Man rebelled against God. But even then, God did not stop loving man, and He did not give up His plan to bless man. And He sent Jesus to do that so we could be here tonight studying God's Word, remembering once again who we really are, remembering why we're here, because God created us, but knowing that that God who created us, He also sent His Son to die for us. And having given us His Son, He's going to freely give us all things through Him.